Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show. Filling in for Brian today, I'm Juan Manuel Benitez, host of Pura Política on New York One Noticias. If you live in a rent-stabilized apartment, you're going to see a small increase in your rent, up to 2%. Is that too much or too little? We will take your calls. Also, we will be asking for your stories on student debt. Do you have any? Do you ever talk about it? A lot of people did talk to Anna Sale about it. We have a preview of her latest Death, Sex, and Money podcast episode. And Henry Olsen will tell us the things Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan have in common. His book, The Working Class Republican. All this and more today on The Brian Lehrer Show. And we begin with Trump and Russia, or how we like to call it here on The Brian Lehrer Show, Trusha. On Monday, the White House sent a warning to the Assad regime in Syria. He will pay a heavy price if he conducts another attack on his people using chemical weapons. The White House said it had identified potential preparations for a chemical attack similar to the one from April 4th. After that attack, the U.S. military fired cruise missiles at the base where the suspected bombers took off. Now, hours before the White House issued the warning, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson warned his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, according to the Daily Beast. Tillerson would have told Lavrov that there will be consequences if the chemical attack were to take place. Let's remember that the Russian government is an ally of the Assad regime in Syria. Let's also remember that the Russian government and the Assad regime said that the April 4th chemical attack never happened. Why did Tillerson feel the need to warn Russia before the statement was released? Why didn't the White House warn Russia publicly? To talk about this and more, we have one of the Daily Beast reporters who broke the story. Spencer Ackerman is a senior national security correspondent for the Daily Beast and a former U.S. national security editor for The Guardian. Good morning, Spencer.
Thanks for having me, Juan.
Why did Tillerson feel the need to call his Russian counterpart?
So the Russians are effectively the Assad regime's main sponsors, along with the Iranians. There's generally an assumption in policymaking circles in Washington and beyond that once Russia intervened in 2015 militarily to essentially bail out the Assad regime from its enemies, that the regime is going to not make a move to get crosswise with Russia. So right before, maybe a couple hours before, the White House issued a public warning to the Assad regime not to use chemical weapons, its Secretary of State called his counterpart in Moscow to tell him, essentially, you know, come for your man. Make sure that your guy doesn't get out of pocket here one more time.
So those consequences that the White House was talking about are consequences against the Syrian regime, also against Russia?
It's kind of like the chocolate is mixed up in the peanut butter here. The air base in April that the U.S. struck with those 59 Tomahawk missiles you mentioned has Russian personnel at it as well, Russian aircraft, Russian material. It all operates out of the same structure so that the Russians understand that they're kind of not quite held hostage, but they're held in check should there be a U.S. military action on that base or other installations a second time. Now, the first time around, the U.S. quietly reached out to the Russians as well before the attack was launched in order to make sure that no Russian personnel died in the strike. That would be a tremendous escalation that Washington isn't prepared to take yet. Certainly the Trump administration isn't prepared to take yet. No one wants to start World War III over Syria. So the idea is that not only would the Russians not want that strike to resume, but it might see that it has a rather personal human stake in making sure that it doesn't happen.
What was the reaction from Sergei Lavrov to Tillerson's phone call?
Our sources indicate that Lavrov, like he has previously, both publicly and privately, said that, you know, nothing like this is going to happen. Do you have any evidence that it's actually going to happen? These sorts of things that the Russians typically do to obfuscate, to suggest that these are malicious accusations raised against Russia in order to weaken it, rather than taking it as a serious possibility, given the several different chemical weapon strikes against Syrian civilians that the Assad regime has launched already.
And knowing the background of Rex Tillerson, who has been friendly for years to many members of the Russian government in his previous job as an executive of an oil company, is this phone call between him and Lavrov a friendly phone call, or is it a phone call between enemies?
It would certainly be a tense phone call. The Trump administration's decision to attack Syria is at this point perhaps the premier stumbling block between the rapprochement that Donald Trump certainly wants to have, Rex Tillerson certainly wants to have, with Russia, and the broader realities of the Syrian civil war and the traditional U.S. posture in it, and certainly the traditional U.S. posture that leans between skeptical to adversarial towards Russia.
We want to hear from our listeners. We want to know what your take is on this. You can call us at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And Spencer, are we reading too much into all this? Wouldn't we expect the two major powers involved in this conflict to communicate often about their actions on the ground?
Certainly. One of the things that, you know, since the Russians intervened militarily in Syria, the U.S. has tried to do is figure out how it can continue to wage its end of the Syrian war, that is, against the Islamic State, without potentially running into Russian aircraft and Russian personnel, and it's getting increasingly complicated. The U.S. recently shot down Syrian fighter jets. It shot down Syrian drones. And in general, there's kind of a convergence on the map between U.S. ground proxies, U.S. forces, that is to say U.S. special operations forces, and the allies of the Syrian regime and the Russians. The map is kind of constricting right now, as it looks like there's going to be a major conflict to take away Raqqa from the Islamic State in Syria. And so in general, both sides, well, certainly the U.S. side, is trying to make sure that as it moves on towards its objectives against the Islamic State, that it doesn't end up stumbling into a much larger war with the Russians.
Do you think, because this statement happened on Monday, this warning from the White House happened on Monday, do you think that there is a possibility that the White House was using this to distract from the healthcare battle in the Senate, or just to change the conversation in general?
I have no idea, frankly. The sources that we talked to for this piece indicated that they felt that there was at least enough there in the intelligence, that basically they had gotten indications that at least look like the kinds of preparatory stages for a chemical attack that it had seen in the past as a prelude to those actual attacks, that it wanted to at least throw a brushback pitch to Syria and Russia to make sure that it didn't happen. Its broader political timing, that's just honestly something I don't cover and don't know about. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't want to mislead you or your listeners.
Right. So as of today, Wednesday, because this happened on Monday, like we said, is the White House still expecting this chemical attack to happen?
Right now, it's kind of in a wait-and-see mode and trying to see what the actual impact of that warning was, what the impact of Tillerson's call to Lavrov may have been. It's also significant to note that the indications that they had that there might have been another chemical attack coming raises a question about what the April airstrike actually achieved. If the purpose of that, I'm sorry, not airstrike, missile strike actually achieved, if the purpose of the Tomahawk missile strike was to impose a price, a consequence on the Assad regime for launching another chemical attack, and the chemical attack, at least in preparatory stages, might have gone forward, then really what did the April strike actually result in? And it's just sort of an open question at this point.
And we just have some news, Spencer, on this. There's an AP news alert saying that Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says Syria's government has taken seriously the U.S. warning against launching another chemical weapons attack. So I guess this had the effect that the White House wanted it to have?
If there's not going to be another chemical attack, then yes.
Okay. So let's take some phone calls. We have Michael in Queens. Michael in Queens, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show. Good morning. Michael, are you there?
Michael may be too happy about Phil Jackson's firing from the Knicks.
I know. I heard that you're a big Knicks fan, so you're not really happy about it today. Is that true?
Juan, I'm just overjoyed beyond that with which I can possibly express. I'm honored to be on your show. I'm honored to be on the Brian Lehrer Show and get to talk to the city on such a momentous and joyous day.
Let's go with Chris in the Upper West Side. Chris, good morning. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Good morning. Your guest spoke of asking Russian, you know, he said the Russian was a diplomat that got the phone call asking for evidence. And you said that's like some typical, you used the word obfuscation that Russians use. I don't see how asking for evidence, given our history of using lies to get into every war in the last 50 years, is obfuscation. We look at what just happened in Iraq. Look at just what happened in Vietnam in the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, where's your history? Of course, ask for information.
So, Spencer,
Information. I'm sorry. Ask for evidence. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen any.
Thank you, Chris. So, Spencer, do you think that it's a normal response by the Russian government?
I mean, it's certainly a typical response. It's also denying reality, notwithstanding what your caller said, that the Syrian regime has launched devastating chemical attacks on its own people, and that regime continues to enjoy Russian sponsorship.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris. We're going to try again with Michael. Well, we don't have Michael anymore. But Spencer, like, this caller has a point in saying, well, the U.S., many times in the past, the intelligence that the U.S. government got indicated that there were some weapons somewhere, and then later the U.S. discovered that wasn't true. So is there a valid point from other governments, in this case the Russian government, asking the U.S. government for evidence to that accusation?
I want to disaggregate this somewhat. I think there is definitely a valid point from people like your listener and from all Americans when they hear about secret intelligence that may be used to support a military attack, whether that exists, how valid it is, how robust it is, how reliable it is. That is completely the right questions to ask in this case. But it's not like Sergei Lavrov is a disinterested party. It's not like Sergei Lavrov and the Russian government don't know for a fact that the Assad regime launches chemical attacks on its own people. It's not like this is a secret to the world. In that case, asking for evidence here is a matter of statecraft. It's not a matter of intellectual rigor or skepticism. It's a matter of pushing back on something that it doesn't want to be held accountable for.
And let's hear from David in Manhattan. David, good morning. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you. Is Trump in danger of drawing red lines here? Obama, of course, famously went public far too early, threatening the Assad regime. Here we go again. And I'm very worried that given Trump's temperament, he'd be very likely not to climb down after making a threat. And he, you know, all of this should really have been done in secret.
Thank you, David. What do you think, Spencer?
I think that's a very good point. There, for whatever the administration wants to emphasize that it's not drawing any red lines. In many cases, the way statecraft works is paying less attention to the words used and more attention to the effect of the actions at stake here. And in that case, there really is a question with the history of Barack Obama explicitly drawing a red line and then allowing it to be violated without consequence, of both the Syrians and the Russians seeing how far they can push the United States or what the point is at which the U.S. will respond militarily. And now that Trump has set a precedent, it's to be expected that the Syrians and the Russians would want to see if he will continue to enforce that precedent.
So, Spencer, while this was happening, while the White House was warning Syria and Russia with a phone call about this, the president was actively tweeting, but not about Syria or chemical weapons. He was attacking some media outlets for the coverage on the Russia matter, calling CNN once again fake news. Is this a surprise to you that the White House is doing one thing and Donald Trump is doing another?
It seems in a lot of cases now, particularly on national security, that Trump is kind of taking a step back, that it disinterests him, certainly relative to what he sees irritating him in political coverage. He's conceded a tremendous amount of decision-making authority to the defense secretary, Jim Mattis, particularly over the Afghanistan war, and in many cases to people inside the U.S. national security establishment, is starting to create a sense that he's washing his hands of functions within the presidency that require national and senior level attention.
Because isn't it a little confusing for reporters covering the White House and Washington, D.C. right now that we hear one thing from the White House and then another thing from Donald Trump? Wouldn't we assume that both entities, the White House and Donald Trump, act in accordance, that they go together when they are trying to deliver a message?
Under normal presidencies, yes, and we're just not in that situation anymore. And the challenge for reporters at this point is to see, after noting what the president says and what he seems to be doing, to then go back and essentially check that with our sources who are on the end of implementing these policies or are in the room when decisions are taken. And at this point, that seems to be just, you know, the way that we have to operate as reporters. And I think, you know, that's probably to some degree a healthy sign that perhaps we weren't doing as much of that in the past.
Mm-hmm. Let's go with Ryan in Clark, New Jersey. Ryan, good morning. Welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. So I saw an article, and I've been frantically trying to look for it in the last couple minutes to source it. But the article pointed out that there were a couple of Pentagon officials that made the claim that they were unaware of any of the claims or intelligence that Donald Trump was citing as a threat. Is your guest aware of any of that? And, you know, have we confirmed that the intelligence is threatening, or is there a possibility that this is all just political theater because Trump needs a win really, really badly?
Just let's also clarify, Spencer, before you respond, that mm-hmm. Donald Trump didn't cite any evidence or anything. He basically didn't do much on this issue. It was the White House releasing this statement, correct?
That's correct. It was the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer. First, your caller is correct. One of those pieces, I think the caller might have seen, was by my friend Nancy Youssef of BuzzFeed, formerly of the Daily Beast, who got officials at U.S. Central Command to say that they basically had no idea what Trump was talking about. Lots of us over the period after which Spicer made his statement talked to officials at the Pentagon and elsewhere who were at least taken by surprise, perhaps somewhat on the intelligence end of it or somewhat on the decision to speak about it publicly by the statement that Spicer made. We know that there was we've been able to confirm that there was at least a high-level meeting in recent days before the statement that Spicer made on the general topic of Syria. I am not particularly clear about whether this specific intelligence or indications of a potential chemical attack were discussed at this meeting, but it definitely seems to have been a closely held thing. We reported that, particularly within the White House, only a few officials were kept in the loop on this. Other officials did not, including those who are in positions of responsibility here, didn't go so far as to say that the intelligence was nonsense. So I'm not really sure about that. But given that this was intelligence indicating that there might be a potential attack, we're definitely in the realm of something speculative and something open to interpretation.
Let's hear from Rami in Somerset County, New Jersey. Rami, welcome to the Brian Lehrer Show.
Hi, thanks for having me on. My question is, I'm Arab American, and I've seen a lot on my Facebook feed and through family parties and whatnot. A lot of the pro-Assad people that I know, unfortunately, always bring up the question, why would Assad use chemical weapons if he's winning the war? And I don't prescribe to that logic myself, but I was wondering what your guest thought of that comment. And as a follow-up, I've also heard that the airbase that was struck with the 59 Tomahawk missiles, actually half the missiles missed and it was operational the next day. Now, I was wondering if he knew anything regarding that piece of news as well.
Thank you, Rami.
Yeah, so first off, the purpose of the missile strike in April was to essentially create a punitive situation as well as a deterrent, not destroy the whole airbase, not even destroy particularly, and this is an important point, the chemical weapons facilities that are at that base for the obvious environmental risks that blowing up stockpiles of chemical weapons and precursors would cause. So there's always been a question since the strike itself about what operationally it actually achieved. And it also points to the extreme difficulties and perhaps fundamental difficulties with military action against chemical weapons. You just have a situation in which you could actually make a circumstance worse environmentally, or you create a pinprick that the offending nation feels like it has survived. So that's one of the ways in which once you take actions like this, wars can escalate and can certainly sustain themselves rather than actually resolving the situation at issue. As to the question of why would Assad do this if he's winning the war, well, he hasn't won the war. He is trying to win the war. He's in a rather strong position to win the war, but there's extreme pockets of resistance. And the question with a kind of war like this one is, what does the Assad regime think winning is? No matter, even if he ultimately retains a hold on territory in Syria, he's clearly considered by many Syrians, if not most Syrians, to be a butcher, to be someone who they will oppose, particularly after 6 years of this devastating, grueling carnage, until they die and pass that on to their children. So once you're in as existential a crisis as this has been for the Assad regime, all of the logic points toward increasing brutality.
And like we said before, Spencer, while the White House, Sean Spicer, was giving that warning to Syria, the president was tweeting, but not about this, but about the media, what he calls the fake news media. And last week, CNN had to retract a story on its website about a Russian bank linked to a close ally of President Trump being under investigation. Three journalists resigned because of this at CNN. And President Trump used this to keep claiming the media are conspiring against his administration. Yesterday, his White House spokesperson, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, went on and on about it. Let's take a listen.
News outlets get to go on day after day and cite unnamed sources, use stories without sources, have, you mentioned the Scaramucci story where they had to have reporters resign. Come
on. That was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Deputy White House Press Secretary. It happened yesterday during the press briefing, and it was Playboy reporter Brian Karim who jumped to CNN's defense. Let's listen.
Come on. You're inflaming everybody right here and right now with those words. This administration has done that as well. Why in the name of heavens any one of us, right, are replaceable, and any one of us, if we don't get it right, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us.
I think you have
been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions.
Right.
You're here to provide the answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everybody else out here is fake media. And everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
I disagree completely. First of all, I think if anything has been inflamed, it's the dishonesty that often takes place by the news media.
That was Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Deputy Press Secretary at the White House, and Playboy reporter Karim. And Spencer, I want to hear your reaction as a reporter covering the White House. What do you think about the interaction?
I think it's probably going to be the sort of interaction we'll see more and more from the White House and reporters covering it. CNN messed up, and they addressed it. They addressed it the way that reporters and editors at mainstream media organizations do again and again and again, which is they impose accountability after they make mistakes. We should probably, all of us, whether we're in journalism or whether we're in other industries, do more and more of that. Nothing is ever going to be wrong with holding ourselves accountable. That's the right thing to do.
And let me say again,
if I could just continue.
Of course.
That's a two-way street, though. Think about what it means for the White House to be saying, don't trust the media. Don't trust the people who hold us accountable by design and are referenced in that role in the First Amendment to the Constitution. That's an authoritarian mindset. That's a mindset that says we are, in fact, beyond accountability, that your reliance on truth, your need to know the truth, comes from the President of the United States and the White House alone. That's to ensure that there won't be accountability on the government. That's to set this country on a very dangerous path. And reporters ought to challenge that, and we will.
And let me repeat the name of the reporter that challenged the Deputy White House Press Secretary. His name is Brian Karim. He's the Playboy reporter at the White House. And many people in the administration and coming from the White House, and also many readers, viewers, listeners, they are complaining that in many instances, us reporters covering politics today, we use anonymous sources way too often. As someone who covers the White House and some delicate issues like war and peace, like you do, Spencer, can you explain a little bit to our listeners why someone like you, a reporter, would have to use sources that are asking for anonymity, but at the same time, you believe what they are saying and you have to report the news?
Yeah, absolutely. Particularly in the national security realm, which is what I cover, most people who actually know what's going on aren't cleared to speak. We're talking about people in very delicate positions dealing with very sensitive information. And only through basically years of doing our jobs do we get to interact with these people, do we get to meet these people, and do we get to use them to check information that we get. Most often than not, in every single administration, people will only speak to you if you leave out their names. This is normal behavior in journalism. I think there's kind of a conflation going on, feel free for your listeners to consider this a very biased and certainly parochial perspective, and I'll cop to that. But there's a difference between that and political journalism that uses anonymous sources to bash specific people or to advance particular political agendas. There's always going to be politics and national security, don't get me wrong, but when we're talking about operational issues, when we're talking about issues of diplomacy, when we're trying to figure out what actually happened here or didn't happen, almost overwhelmingly, the choice is going to be rely on people who need to speak anonymously, request speaking anonymously, and accepting wholesale the official line. And I don't think readers, listeners, and viewers are better served by accepting the official line. And the White House in this circumstance is not a neutral party here. It is trying to advance not just a view of the world and a political agenda, but increasingly a view of reality that is entirely centered around it and its agenda. And the question then becomes, for the conscientious consumer of journalism and certainly political news, which is better and which is worse? And you have the choice of what you consume.
You're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show. Spencer Ackerman is a senior national security correspondent for The Daily Beast. We have to leave it there. Thank you, Spencer.
Juan, thank you so much for having me, and thanks, everyone, for paying attention.